From the Voice of America, this is International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. On today's special program, we examine protests from around the world that have shaped 2019. What are the underlying reasons for the protests in Asia, the Middle East, Latin America, and elsewhere? We'll have all that and a whole lot more coming up next. We begin today's program with a look at the events that have taken place in the Chinese Special Administrative Region of Hong Kong. Once a British colony, Hong Kong reverted to Chinese control in 1997 under the One Country, Two Systems guidelines that were put into place to secure some of the freedoms residents had that are not shared by most of those on the mainland. Hong Kong is governed by the Basic Law, and the head of the government there is the chief executive. More than 6 months ago, a bill was introduced that would allow authorities to extradite those accused of crimes in Hong Kong to be tried in mainland courts. That sparked protests that filled the streets, sometimes by the millions. In addition, the song Glory to Hong Kong has become the movement's unofficial anthem, with Specty user Ricky Chung captured and, as the people sang, as the siege of the Hong Kong Polytechnic University was underway. So how did these things get to where they are now? For that, I spoke with Dean Chung, senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation.
Since 1997 is a slow, steady erosion of Hong Kong's autonomy. We have seen more and more restrictions on the press. We have seen the Chinese pressure Hong Kong to come into line with Beijing. One of the best known cases was several booksellers were selling books, exposés about the Chinese Communist Party senior leadership. Perfectly legal within Hong Kong, but these books are banned in China. All of a sudden, a number of these booksellers disappeared. They turned up in China. They confessed to crimes. Some of them were jailed. But there, at least one of the people who was detained said basically that they had been heavily pressured and interrogated by Chinese authorities, all clearly in violation of Hong Kong's autonomy.
So if we take a look at what's going on now, it originally started with this extradition bill. And I wonder if you could kind of explain what upset people in Hong Kong so much that they really turned out en masse, sometimes millions at a time, to protest against this.
So the proximate cause of these protests was a decision by the senior leadership of Hong Kong, especially Ms. Carrie Lam, to basically create an extradition treaty between Hong Kong and mainland China, also with Taiwan, interestingly, where basically people who had been accused of crimes for which a warrant had been issued, especially in China, could be extradited out of Hong Kong to the mainland. Now, this obviously created some serious questions because China's police authorities do not operate under constitutional constraints and civil liberty laws that, for example, exist in Hong Kong. What this really tapped into, however, was a broader, deeper sense of resentment that has been building among Hong Kongese that China has been broadly pressuring and broadly influencing Hong Kong.
But the last question I want to ask you is, you know, it was a 50-year window that Hong Kong was going to have this special kind of semi-autonomous nature that ends in 2047. So with the protests going on, not only this protest, but if we look back a few years to the umbrella movement, what happens, you know, in 2047?
The 2047 deadline is a big part of why so many young people are protesting in Hong Kong. As many of these younger protesters have pointed out, in 2047, they may well be in their 40s or 50s. They will still be in the most productive parts of their lives. They look ahead and see a time when even the more attenuated civil liberties they currently have may completely evaporate. And that's a major factor in the protests. The other aspect here is that what they foresee is a steady erosion between now and 2047, which is certainly possible given that China, in a sense, wants to acclimate the population to more restrictions come 2047. And this was part of the umbrella movement when Beijing basically said that while you, the people of Hong Kong, may have the right to vote for your candidates, we, Beijing, will determine who those candidates will be.
So on a final note, what is probably the one thing that if we take a look at the global audience who may not be so in tune with the nuances of Hong Kong and its relationship to Beijing, what is the one thing that they may glean from all these protests and need to consider as events continue?
The elements to keep in mind here is, first off, a general skepticism on the part of the people of Hong Kong after 22 years of growing Chinese rule that Beijing actually will abide by the terms of agreements. The other aspect here to keep in mind is that Beijing, which once upon a time looked upon Hong Kong as the goose that lays golden eggs and had a more hands-off attitude, has been steadily increasing its pressure on Hong Kong because it recognizes that at the end of the day, in some ways, it holds all of the high cards.
And that was Dean Chang, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Another region that has seen protests is the Middle East. Protests in Iraq have at times turned deadly. Over 400 people, mostly young, unarmed protesters, have been killed by Iraqi forces since mass anti-government protests broke out on October 1st. More than a dozen members of the security forces have also died in clashes. The unrest is Iraq's biggest challenge since Islamic State militants seized swaths of Iraqi and Syrian territory in 2014. In Lebanon, the country has witnessed some of the largest protests since nationwide demonstrations broke out on October 17th against widespread corruption and mismanagement. The protesters are demanding an end to the rule of the political elite that has run the country since the 1975-1990 civil war. In Iran, security forces may have killed more than 1,000 people since protests over gasoline price hikes began in mid-November, and many thousands were also wounded in the unrest. Those demonstrations, which began on November 15th after the Iranian government abruptly raised fuel prices by as much as 300%, spread to more than 100 cities and towns and turned political as young and working class protesters demanded clerical leaders step down. Nearly a decade after the anti-government protests, commonly referred to as the Arab Spring, what has now led to the current state of unrest? That's the question I put forward to Emily Hawthorne, Middle East and North Africa analyst at Stratfor.
I think a lot of the drivers to the protests that we saw 10 years ago have not been solved in the region. And I think we're specifically seeing protests popping up in areas that really didn't see a lot of changes during the Arab Spring. We're seeing a lot of protests in Iraq and Lebanon. We're seeing protests in Algeria. And then Iran, of course, we're also seeing protests. Of course, it's a not the Arab world, but it is connected in sort of this broad arc of people being upset about income inequality, about elite entrenchment, struggling against a corrupt political class, and a whole host of other reasons. But none of those drivers that caused and led people to protest in the Arab Spring 10 years ago, none of them have really been solved.
So what do the protests that we're seeing today do in terms of stability for the region?
The protests that we're seeing today, especially in Iraq and Lebanon, it really is likely for the rest of the year that we see demonstrations pop up, that we see civil society organizations continue to argue and fight against what the government is willing to offer them in terms of political concessions. In short, likely more instability in the offing. And that's in part because these government systems, especially in places like Iraq and Lebanon that have confessional systems, they are very difficult to change. And so it's going to be a process over the coming year of a sort of tug of war between the political elite and the activist class, tugging of war over what the political elite is willing to give up in terms of political concessions and what people are willing to accept.
Let's talk about Iran for a moment, because they're facing sanctions from the United States. They are increasing their output of fissile material for nuclear development, and they're having these incredible protests where some estimates say that there could be 1,000 people that have been killed during them. What do you see taking place in the next year or so for Iran?
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the nuclear development situation in conjunction with the demonstrations that we're seeing in Iran, because they really are connected. I mean, sanctions, U.S. sanctions are compounding with an already mismanaged economy that needed investment to grow. Inflation right now is at 42%. So Iranians really are being squeezed economically, they are no doubt deeply unhappy about the U.S. sanctions. But they also blame their own Iranian government for making decisions that helped incur those sanctions. But this connects to Iranian government's decision to continue developing their nuclear program, because Iran is hoping to be able to outlast the economic pressure, outlast the sanctions pressure, despite the impact that this has on average Iranians, hoping that the 2020 U.S. presidential elections yield a more negotiation-friendly administration. So they're really planning to batten down the hatches, weather out the sanctions storm, even if that means more economic pressure on Iranians, more protests, and more violent crackdowns.
You mentioned that this is likely to go on for some time, regardless of the country. But is this more of an internal process that needs to be resolved, or is this something that the international community can lend itself to bring about some kind of solution that all parties can be happy with?
The international community can play a really important role in pressuring governments to not resort to violent means of putting down protests. It can also provide much-needed loans, grants, and funding to sort of help governments at least scrape by. But ultimately, solutions have to come from within a country in order for them to actually last. So the Iraqi government, Iraqi stakeholders are going to have to come up with reform for the electoral system that satisfies Iraqi's demand for a system that suits their needs. And the same in Lebanon and the same in Iran.
Emily Hawthorne is with Stratfor, and she covers and analyzes the Middle East and North Africa. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo earlier in December accused Cuba and Venezuela of attempting to hijack democratic protests in Latin America, vowing that Washington would support countries trying to prevent unrest in the region from turning into riots.
And so we in the Trump administration will continue to support countries trying to prevent Cuba and Venezuela from hijacking those protests. And we'll work with legitimate governments to prevent protests from morphing into riots and violence that don't reflect the democratic will of the people.
Amid recent demonstrations in a number of countries in the region, Pompeo stepped up U.S. allegations that Cuba and Venezuela had helped stir unrest, but offered few specifics to back up his comments. So what led to the demonstrations in Bolivia, Ecuador, Chile, Colombia, that some have called a Latin American Arab Spring? For that, I spoke with Elizabeth Zeichmeister, political science professor at Vanderbilt University.
I think it's a good question, and it's a question that is hard to answer with a single sort of, you know, we're not going to find one single factor that's driving these protests. But I think we can find some general trends, and one of the ways that I do that is through my work with our survey project, the America's Barometer, which is a regular survey of the Western Hemisphere. And what we find in that survey is that the public mood with respect to their support for democracy and their satisfaction with democracy has been souring for the last several years. I think the public assesses the value of democracy based on how well democracy lives up to its promise. And especially in Latin America, that promise includes state provision of a reasonable quality of life. How do we know that? In our survey project, the America's Barometer, we ask people questions about the extent to which the state should be responsible for things like the reduction of income inequality. And we see that large majorities in most countries feel that the state should be responsible for redistribution that benefits most members of the public. Yet on that and on other issues, the state in many countries has been failing to deliver. And the state has been failing to deliver on at least three core dimensions: clean government, physical security, and economic well-being. On each of those dimensions, the trends in Latin America have been running in a negative direction in recent years.
Now, if we take a look at the number of different protests in these different countries, did one begin initially and kind of inspired others to take up those protests in their own respective nations?
I don't have evidence of that directly, but it certainly seems as though there has been some diffusion of protest. I think that's made possible by the fact that there is a, and has been for years now, a simmering of discontent. And when you have a simmering of discontent and you have a public that is turned sour on democratic institutions and processes and the governments in these countries, then you have a situation where you have the kindling for protest in place and you're waiting for some type of catalyst. And that catalyst might be an action that's taken by a political elite, by a government, or it could be seen the expression of discontent emerge in the streets in another country. So I think that Again, I don't have direct evidence of this, but it seems quite plausible, given the evidence that we do have, that there is a feeling of dissatisfaction with democracy and with the state that's been brewing in the region for a few years now, that's the sort of perfect situation in which the observance of protests in another country would trigger protest in a particular case.
Since we are talking about so many different countries, is there anything that stood out to you watching the events unfold in Latin America that you found particularly striking?
I think one of the interesting things is that despite the fact that in broad brushstrokes, there looks to be a lot of similarity to what's happening, and that we're seeing this expression of public discontent with the system, that in fact there are some really interesting and different divergent dynamics across the region. So in some cases, like in Chile and Ecuador, the driving factor, though there is more than one factor involved, the driving factor is the lack of economic opportunity, increasing economic vulnerability. And in other cases, like the case of Peru, the factor that seems to be the most important factor driving recent instability in the countries is corruption. So again, I think these three factors matter in every country. These three factors are clean government, physical security, and economic well-being. And in the case of Latin America, what we're seeing is these trends in a negative direction on those three factors. But if you take a closer look at the different countries in the region, you see that in some cases, one of those factors is more prominent as an explanation for recent protests than in another case.
What does your data show, hard numbers, as, you know, the significant, not only things that are at the top of their list that they are most concerned about, but the things that they need and want to see addressed?
Yeah, at the top of the list in terms of what people want to see addressed in the region are economic opportunity, economic well-being, and physical security. So crime and violence and a declining set of economic opportunities and sort of a declined sense of well-being in that area, increasing economic insecurity are the sort of two baskets that are at the top of people's list of issues that they hope their governments can address.
And that was Elizabeth Zechmeister, political science professor at Vanderbilt University. 2019 also saw a powerful wave of climate protests around the world. In September, a series of week-long strikes and demonstrations deemed the Global Week for Future were organized ahead of the UN Climate Summit.
We are in Genova, Italy, protesting against climate change because politicians today are not willing to do enough about it.
Inspired by Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg, the events began on September 20th in what many have been called the largest climate demonstrations ever held. Organizers reported that more than 4 million people from 150 countries around the world took part in the youth-led protests. International Edition's Lori London spoke to one young climate activist.
Nina Agrawal Hardin is a 16-year-old activist working locally and nationally with Zero Hour and the Sunrise Movement to organize climate strikes and prepare for the 2020 elections. Nina, you were heavily involved in the September events. Why do you think they caught fire the way they did?
I think part of it is seeing young people like Greta Thunberg and others like her around the world who are making these really high sacrifice actions of skipping school on Fridays and in some ways sacrificing their childhoods or their adolescence to advocate for this cause, I think has been really moving both to other young people and to adults. But I also think we have reached kind of a tipping point where it's very hard to ignore some of the effects of climate change that are already happening. I know for me, like, I wake up every day to new headlines about flooding or wildfires or tropical storms or, you know, ice caps melting. And so I think people are starting to feel this same sense of urgency that scientists have been trying to convey for decades and are realizing, like, this is really our last chance. So I think it's a combination of noticing the effects and noticing what people are doing to try to do something about it.
You mentioned waking up every morning and seeing a new story. You've only been on the planet 16 years. You've not been in the world where this was not something that you were aware of. So this is what you've basically inherited. Do you feel anxious? Do you feel anxiety when you think about what could lie ahead and what is happening if things don't change?
A lot of us who are young people in the climate justice space refer to it as climate anxiety, and we talk about it a lot, and it's definitely shaped the ways in which we've grown up and what our priorities are.
Since that massive, massive day of protest, we've had more waves of protests taking place around the world, more people coming out. The Fridays for Future that was started by Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg continue. She was in Madrid as well at the recent climate summit, talking about how, despite the fact that all these people have come out and despite all these Fridays of skipped school, carbon emissions have gone in the wrong direction. They are nothing substantial is being done. So would you say protests aren't working, or would you say they need to get louder and more consistent?
So first of all, I think Greta's absolutely right. We have not seen any significant action on this issue from world leaders, and that is really disappointing. For me, at least, it's not surprising. And I don't think any of us thought that this would be easy. I mean, we're up against decades and decades and decades of misinformation and corruption. And we know that the task we have ahead of us is massive. And I think in a lot of ways, the way that I look at the movement thus far is kind of like we've been setting the stage. We've been building up to where we need to get. And I think my general sense is that the people I work with are ready to go all in.
Climate change is now leading as one of the most important issues facing the world, according to a new survey of young people published by Amnesty International. And along the lines of what you just said, there was a quote I heard recently about one of the protests in Washington, D.C., where they were blocking traffic and inconveniencing people. And one of the protesters said, well, this might be an inconvenience, but the climate crisis is going to actually change our lives fundamentally. So if we don't solve the climate issue, literally nothing else matters. Would you say that's pretty accurate as to how most young people feel?
I mean, I can't speak for all young people, but for me, there's a lot that I'm willing to give up and there's a lot that I'm willing to sacrifice, because if you look at climate as the intersectional issue that it is, you see that it is a race issue, it is an economic issue, it is, you know, it encompasses all of these other things that we're working towards in our societies. And so for me, if we don't manage to save our planet, then nothing else does matter. We're going to have to disrupt business as usual if we want to get people to pay attention, if we want to mobilize people, and if we want to make actual change. So those disruptive actions, I know they're controversial, but I think they're also necessary.
And that was Nina Agrawal Hardin speaking to International Edition's own Lori London. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our production staff here, thank you very much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.